I am delighted to welcome to our program a journalist who I first read about this week. As a matter of fact, my producer, Matt, handed me a very interesting article written by Asra Nomani. Asra Nomani, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Welcome.
Thank you.
You worked as a reporter for the Wall Street Journal for 15 years, and you're author of a book called Standing Alone, an American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam.
Right.
You also have an association with Georgetown University School of Journalism, as I understand it.
Yeah, I teach journalism at Georgetown, right, through their English department.
All right. And you have written a very interesting article, which essentially is entitled Airport Security, Let's Profile Muslims. And you write, amongst other things, as an American Muslim, I've come to recognize, sadly, that there is one common denominator defining those who have got their eyes trained on U.S. targets. Many of them are Muslim, like the Somali-born teen arrested Friday night for a reported plot to detonate a car at a packed Christmas tree lighting ceremony a week ago tonight. We have to talk about the taboo topic of profiling because the terrorism experts are increasingly recognizing that religious ideology makes terrorist organizations and terrorists more likely to commit heinous crimes against civilians, such as blowing an airliner out of the sky. Certainly, it is not an easy or comfortable conversation, but it's one I believe we must have. It must take tremendous courage for a Muslim woman to write as boldly as you've written.
Yeah, for some time now I've been thinking this and was afraid to actually express it because, as you know, there's just so much of a dirty word association with profiling. And I've just have come to feel, you know, just like a lot of people who look at the headlines and see what the threat looks like out there, that we've got to be honest about the threat coming from within our Muslim community. You know, for many years now, I've known this and been fighting against it inside of our American Muslim community also. And I think we just have to take that step further now and accept the place of religion in making our threat assessment.
Now, I'm sure that your thoughts have been affected dramatically by your friendship and your professional relationship with David Pearl.
Yeah. You know, when I was growing up, I really learned a very tolerant expression of Islam. And so my best friend in sixth grade was a girl named Karen Svoboda. And then when I went to this sixth grade dance and learned how to square dance, because I grew up in West Virginia, mm-hmm. it was with a boy named David Stitzel. His mom and father were Jewish, and they lived across town, and his mom was starting the women's studies department. Then when I grew up, I ended up meeting in the Wall Street Journal, Washington Bureau, this new reporter, Danny Pearl, who was really fun and introduced me to, you know, the social life of American society that I hadn't really known as a good American Muslim girl. I got to have my high school prom that I never was allowed to attend when I was 28. We threw a party that we called the Midsummer Night's Prom. And and all the girls wore their old bridesmaids' dresses, and the guys wore their cheesy tuxedos. And so at 28, I finally had my prom. And so this was just, you know, the kind of friendship that so many of us have in the workplace with someone else. And when I went to Pakistan after September 11th, Danny and his wife, Marianne, came to visit me in a house I'd rented in Karachi. And, you know, 2 days later, he went off for the interview from which he was kidnapped. And 5 weeks later, we discovered that men had murdered Danny in the name of Islam. And so that was really
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as I understand.
Yeah, and how this all just, you know, loops together is that, yes, indeed, it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of the September 11th attacks, who confessed to killing Danny And it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in the early 1990s who created a plot called Bajinka, in which he and Ramzi Youssef, the architect of the first World Trade Center attacks, envisioned putting explosives on 14 airliners from Asia, flying from Asia to the U.S., blowing up, killing thousands of passengers aboard. And so, you know, there's a clear strategy out there that targets airports and airliners, and the architect for that strategy is the same man who has confessed to killing my friend Danny. And, you know, none of the coincidences here escape me, and I think they shouldn't. You know, we should wake up and connect the dots also in making our in our own personal assessment of what risk we face out there.
You have an interesting background. You were born in Bombay, India in 1965, and you came to the United States at the age of four without knowing English. And your English is pluperfect, if you will. You were raised in the foothills of West Virginia near Morgantown, Morgantown, West Virginia, and you got interested in journalism as a high school student. We talk on this program quite a bit about this issue, Asra, and there, I'm not Muslim. You know, I'm Irish Catholic, and I was profiled once.
Right.
I mentioned the story the other day. I was reporting from Northern Ireland, and I was with my producer. I worked in television for the WBZ here in Boston, and we walked. We're walking down a street, the two of us. Peter Maroney, who, if there's anyone who could look more Irish than me, it would have been Peter Maroney. And as we turned a corner, we were walking with our trench coats and our scully caps, and Peter was carrying a valise, a bag of some sort, and all of a sudden we realized we were approaching British troops in Belfast, and as we approached them, clearly their level of concern increased.
Right.
Their rifles came up toward us, and I wasn't even aware of it until I became aware of it, and I said to Peter, let's stop, let's put our hands up, and let's tell them we're Americans. Mm-hmm. And clearly, I did not feel offended by that. If I was a British soldier and I saw me walking down the street looking as Irish as I did in Northern Ireland with another colleague carrying a valise, and yet there are people on this program who adamantly want to maintain sort of the politically correct purity that we should be as concerned about 90-year-old women in wheelchairs, 5-year-old kids with leg braces. You know, I'm sure you've read all the horror stories.
Right.
And you, as a Muslim woman, are advocating something which is likely to going to happen to you when you travel.
Yeah, and that's what I recognize, and I say, you know, please check me out even more. You know, I don't mind, because right now, you know, inside of our Muslim community, we have Muslims who subscribe to this ideology that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed put out there in the world, and Osama bin Laden issues, you know, fatwa after fatwa. And we have to accept the consequence, I think, of the fact that this ideology has emerged in our community, that a militancy has emerged, and because this didn't happen overnight. You know, for the last 40 years, we've had the emergence of this brand of Islam that some people call Islamist. Some people call it political Islam. It's, you know, given all sorts of names.
It's also sort of a Wahhabi.
Wahhabism, yeah. Or Salafism, or, you know, from South Asia, it's called Deobandism. And so there's all these isms, and there's all of these names that you can put on it to sort of, slice it even thinner and thinner, but at the end of the day, it's an interpretation of Islam, and they are Muslims who believe in this. And so if we, you know, what has annoyed me increasingly over the years, and something that I think I share with a lot of people, is that as long as the Muslim community doesn't own the problem, we're never going to get past it. And so every time, you know, a Major Nidal Hassan goes on and does a shooting rampage like he did at Fort Hood, and we go on air and say, oh, he's not a Muslim, we're not dealing with the problem. And you know, I get so much understanding from folks like inside the Catholic community, because the Catholic community has had to deal with that same kind of culture of denial with issues that are considered taboo topics inside of it, right? Like, for example, with the priest issue.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so that's where I say, you know, look, you as an Irish Catholic man get that at one time particular that Irish Catholics were profiled during the militancy inside of the African-American community. African-American men were profiled in the 1960s, you know, when the Black Panthers were around. If you were a pastor at a Black church in 1965 in Birmingham, Alabama, and a bunch of good old white boys came up to you, you know, in a pickup truck, you wouldn't like be like, yeah, come on in, have a cup of coffee. You'd like go out there.
Sure.
And see what they've got going on. So that's profiling.
Absolutely. My guest this hour, a journalist, first and foremost a journalist, but also a very courageous woman. Asra, I'd like to take some phone calls, if you don't mind.
That'd be great.
All right. We're going to start it off with Yolanda in Boston, who says here disagrees with Asra. Yolanda, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine. I want to introduce you to Asra Nomani. And
hello.
All I ask you to do is be respectful and disagree in whatever way you want. Go right ahead.
Oh no! And I'm very impressed by her pedigree. I'm just calling in because I was listening to the station. I listen many nights.
Thank you.
But I'm never a person that calls. I usually just listen.
Well, that's good.
But I'm just in rage. I'm an African American woman. I live in Boston. I'm from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taken aback that she feels that it would be appropriate to racially profile. I think, you know, a couple of things came to me is
I think she's really, Yolanda, I think she's really talking more about religious profiling, but, as opposed to racial profiling.
Asra, oh, okay. And I should have added that I did turn it on in the middle of the program.
Okay. Asra, is that a fair, I just want to make sure that I'm being fair here. Is that a fair characterization?
You know, actually, I mean, I'm happy to talk this through too, but I actually do argue for racial and religious profiling, and the way that I, and just so that I can put some context on it, what I'm talking about also is the fact that not only do we see trends related to religion in terms of threats, especially to airports and airliners, but also in terms of nation of origin and ethnicity, with a lot of, for example, cases of Pakistanis and Yemenis and others that are part of that target group. But I just want to add this clarification, which I completely understand, like the very difficult relationship we as a nation have had with profiling. What I want to suggest is only that we include issues of race and religion in our threat assessment. Not that it starts with, you know, you look at a Muslim and you immediately pull them aside, but that you include these issues and that you don't ignore them.
But I guess, you know, and I can definitely respect your opinion, but what I'm taken aback by is that any group of people should be penalized or treated indifferently because of any difference that they have. You know, basically, I mean, part of the reason I kind of feel like I think that Dan Ray feels it's impressive that you are of Muslim descent and feel this is appropriate, but just kind of given your pedigree and you're not having an accent, my guess is that you probably would not be a person that will be profiled at an airport or in a situation as such. And then, you know, and Dan Ray, actually, I'm a little shocked by you as well, because you gave an example of when you were racially profiled as a youth. And, you know, I think it would be unfair for me to assume that, I mean, and I have many Irish Catholic neighbors, to assume that, you know, they should all be treated in one way because
well, Yolanda, let me respond to that, Yolanda, in case there are people who join the show and leave the show. I was probably ethnically profiled, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm in Northern Ireland working as a reporter with a colleague who looks as Irish as I do. His name was Peter Maroney. And we are walking down a street in Belfast. We come around the corner, and in the middle of the street, about, you know, 50 yards up, as we're walking up the street are some young British soldiers, and they look at us. My colleague is carrying a valise, small suitcase, and I realized that they were becoming more nervous as we approached. Now, I could have said, "Well, you know, I'm here. I'm an American. I'm not with the IRA or anything." But how did they know that? How did they know that?
And I completely get that. And, you know,
I'm not going to be offended and say, "Oh, once again, you know, I'm an Irish Catholic and I'm from America, but here's the British soldier pointing his gun at me." He was doing probably what was the sensible thing to do. And the sensible thing for us to do was to stop and put our hands up and say, "We're Americans."
Oh, absolutely.
And show our identification. So that's all I'm saying.
No, I'm not saying that, you know, there shouldn't be these forms of security at, you know, airports. If people feel safe from these forms of security, if these things make them feel safer, you know, I can respect that. I just personally feel more comfortable if there's going to be a security check done for one person, that it'd be done for all.
So you think the same amount of attention should be paid to the 90-year-old nun or the kid? There was the kid with leg braces in Philadelphia a year ago. He's 5 years old. His dad was a police officer, and he and his wife were taking this little boy with leg braces down to Disney World in Florida. And they made the kid take the leg braces off in order to walk through the
magnum. I definitely think that was an unfortunate situation.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of unfortunate situations.
But let me get her to respond to what you're saying, Yolanda.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I completely hear your worries and your concerns, and I know that as a nation we've had a really difficult relationship with issues of how we target various, ethnic or racial groups when we do threat assessment. People fear, for example, throwback to internment camps and, Muslim-only lines and things like that. But I just want to say that I believe that we have to do this very carefully if we do it. And in fact, you know, what happened as I was researching this is that while the Justice Department has taken a really strong position on issues of profiling, basically, you know, saying that we can't do it in most cases, they do say that in the event of catastrophic disasters, such as an airport event or something like that, you have to be able to allow to include these kind of criteria like race, religion, ethnicity, but we have to be really careful about it. And I think that's really true, just to address, you know, the worries that you and so many other people would have.
Yolanda, a quick final question for me, if I could, and we're coming up on a break. Were you offended by the comment that Juan Williams had made about how he became a little nervous? I was much more offended by the way NPR got rid of Juan Williams. Juan Williams is as open-minded a guy in this business as I know, or I know of. He was a biographer, I believe, of Justice Thurgood Marshall, and he expressed a concern, because that was so-called politically incorrect, it cost him his career at NPR.
I do think that's unfair. I mean, I think particularly if you're in a media field, there should be the opportunity for you to share your opinion, and there should be kind of a freedom of speech, I would say. So I definitely wouldn't feel that someone should lose their position because of, but I'd agree with you there, which I have to say, I don't tend to agree. We actually usually have differing opinions, but I do enjoy your talk show, so I appreciate you taking my call.
Well, Yolanda, I appreciate you calling. You call
okay.
on time. Okay,
thank
great.
You.
Thanks.
Thank
great
you,
call.
Yolanda.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Why are there so few voices from the Muslim community articulating your point of view?
You know, I think it's really this culture of denial that I alluded to earlier that handcuffs just about every community when they feel that they're going to be shamed in public. This is the struggle, like we talked about, that the Vatican has had regarding its own issues. And what we have inside of our community is, you know, this real interesting dynamic in which people have a long sense of history in which there's a lot of pain and anger that still exists decades later after colonialism long ago ended. And the events of 9/11, you know, were ones in which the community said, oh, this is, you know, an expression of anger from inside of our community related to oppression and hatred against, you know, certain Muslims. And in that way, there's been this sort of circling of the wagons around even the Muslims that are preaching this kind of hatred and intolerance. And
well, the Catholic Church did that with the priest. As opposed to dealing with the issue, it was defend the institution.
Right.
I think it's defend the religion here.
Yeah, and just like it's made so many American Catholics so angry, I know, and I'd love to hear from your listeners on this point, because I think that that denial makes a lot of Americans also very frustrated and angry with our Muslim community. And I know that as I go out there and I talk, I feel that people open up even more when they can talk honestly about the problems. And so I always want to say back to my community, like, nobody is going to, you know, judge all of us until, you know, we, like, nobody will judge all of us as long as we are honest about what is happening inside of our community.
I also am a strong believer that within any subset, with any religious or racial or ethnic subset, there is always going to be a diversity of opinion.
Right.
And it just seems to me that that we need to hear diversities of opinion within your community. Let me get a quick call in here before we got to go to another break. Tim in the car. Tim, welcome. You're next on Nightside.
Good evening, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing great. Please say hi to my guest, Asra Nomani.
Good evening, Asra. I got to tell you, I'm very, very impressed with your opinion. I'm not one really for racial profiling, but I can tell you that, unfortunately, if you take a look at it like a dog will say, Rottweilers and pit bulls get more news media for biting people because they do more damage than little dogs, but little dogs are more prone to bite. Unfortunately, but you got people like Timothy McVeigh who did it, just as white as I was. So I think more so than religious and racial profiling, we just have to be more protective, I think, of people that don't see things the way we do in America anymore. And I think there might even be more and more whites and blacks and Puerto Ricans and things like that that might be going that way as well. So maybe we have to pay a little more attention to them as well.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, the situation of Timothy McVeigh is brought up a lot in terms of an example of somebody who wasn't Muslim that committed a terrible act of terrorism inside the U.S. And what I really think is, you know, we can't, you know, do our crime fighting like with one brush, right? And we have to look at where the threat is. And so in the case of airports and airliners, there's been a clear threat expressed from inside of our Muslim community over the last decade. Timothy McVeigh's, you know, violence, I don't think was part of a sort of extremist Christian agenda that has become a pattern and a trend of that magnitude inside of America. But if you're an abortion clinic, you're not going to be targeting and profiling Muslim extremists. You're actually going to be profiling Christian extremists, right? And probably white Christian extremists. And so in that way, I agree with you that the threat can come from so many different groups, and we have to be really specific when we're looking at what the target is to see who the perpetrator might be.
And we certainly do need to monitor some of these wacko, right-wing, militia, quasi-militia groups, because we know that there is the potential. A lot of it is simply talk, but the potential for doing something is always going to be there. But we need to as a society, to protect our society from these people who do go to the woods. I'm not talking about the person who goes to the woods to exercise his Second Amendment, her Second Amendment rights. I'm talking about the whack jobs who are up there doing paramilitary maneuvers. Tim, you're damn right. We got to be concerned about them as well. Thanks, Tim.
Absolutely, Dan. I think you definitely have to be concerned for them. And right. I think really, it's, you know, there's so many people that that. It just, like, politically correct to me is just like the most ridiculous thing in the world. Anyway,
well, you know that I'm not a PC guy.
I think it's also important to remember that when these terrorists get on an airplane, they fly that thing into a tower, or they smash whatever they do, there's no guarantee that they're not killing fellow Muslims. So they could be killing their own.
Of course, well,
people that they're supposedly fighting for. So it's like, you know, come on, man, they're not getting nothing at the end of the ride.
Well, there were Muslims killed on 9/11 in the World Trade Center. Tim, thank you for the call. Let's go next to Bill in Stoneham. Hey, Bill, how are you?
Hi, Dan.
How are you, Bill?
I'm fine, and
please say hi to Asra.
Hi, Asra, and it's nice to hear your refreshing point of view, Asra.
Thank you.
And I propose, Dan, that and Asra, that, you know, I think you're getting off track here with, you know, granted there's paramilitary groups training in the woods and all that, but the focus we should have tonight is the profiling at airports. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's what we're talking about, but I was just using that as an example.
I understand, Dan, and I think you may have posed the question already. I asked, you know, why aren't there more Muslim groups, you know, peaceful Muslim groups in the country? Why aren't they saying more things like Asra's saying and backing, you know, more peace rather than, you know, they don't seem to speak out against any kind of terrorism. They don't seem to speak out against it at all. And also, let me propose before
Bill, don't hang up. Let Asra respond to what you said, and then we'll give you another chance. Go ahead, Asra.
No. Yeah, and what I wanted to do is I wanted to ask you the question. When you do hear the denials, you know, by the Muslim organizations against, you know, the acts of al-Qaeda and other forms of militancy, what is it that doesn't work for you as a listener that sort of makes you feel, in fact, as you do, that the Muslims aren't taking a stand?
The lack of any kind of public outcry or anything in the media at all.
I would agree with Bill. Bill, I would agree with you and Asra. I want to hear more voices. I do. We have had on this program, we have attempted to get a variety of Muslim voices. We've been trying for the last few weeks to get Bilal Kalim, who is the head of the major mosque here in Boston, to come on. I've had Bilal on before, and he has not acquiesced to our invitation. I had Walid Shubat on a few weeks ago, and also a physician, Dr. Yasser from Phoenix, Arizona. I don't know if you're familiar with, but both Shubat and Yasser are from the same point of view as you are.
Right. And when the institutional organizations come out and, you know, condemn al-Qaeda, you know, they've done that. They've done these, like, PSA announcements talking about how Muslims died on 9/11. What is it, though, that's not, that you're not hearing that would, you know, sort of help you?
I'm just not hearing, it seems to me that I'm not hearing much of anything from Muslim groups at all about.
I hear more, Asra, from Ibrahim Hooper,
right,
of the Council on American Islamic Relations, who himself was a convert to Muslim, to Islam, but I hear him all the time. And for some reason, the media, the networks seem to always go to him.
Yeah, what is it that doesn't work about the way he addresses the problem?
Well, I had him on as a guest on the program, and he's one of the few guests who left the program because I asked him some questions that he was had difficulty answering and said, I don't want to answer those questions. I think that they have taken care, CAIR, the Council of American Islamic Relations, have tried to politicize this. And I mean, we've had people on from, there's a group called Revolution Muslim.
Did? Wow, that's amazing. You got them on air.
Well, they're nuts. I mean, they're nuts. But I want to hear from more groups, and I think that's what Bill wants to. Bill, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank Good you. Luck, Asra.
Okay, thank you. And what I feel as a Muslim is that when organizations like the Council on American Islamic Relations deal with these issues of violence and terrorism, they don't own the problem. And, you know, there's lots of excuses and there's lots of, like you said, you know, political explanation.
Rationalization.
Right, a lot of rationalization. And I ask these questions because I've been pondering this on, and because I think that this is fueling some of the anger and disappointment by the larger American community against Muslims. And, you know, people make the distinction. They get that it's not all Muslims, but you get frustrated inside any relationship, right, when you don't feel like there's truth-telling?
Yes. Asra, you've been a fabulous guest.
I
want to have you back. If you ever get to Boston, love to have you in studio. You've reached a big audience tonight. We actually are heard in 38 states here in WBZ, and I'd like to keep in touch with you and have you back.
Absolutely, and I thank everyone for listening and just trying to keep an open heart about, you know, these very, very difficult issues.